Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, local family physician and your host for an hour of medical discussion, debate, dialogue, healthcare and science in the news, maybe a little political news as well. All of that in the next hour on Ask Dr. Dawn. And wait, there's more. Answers to your questions and emails as well. So stay tuned. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. And I want to start out with some very interesting things that came through in the actual news this week. First of all, Monday is National HIV Screening Day. So if you have never been tested for HIV, Monday would be a good day to at least contemplate being tested. The CDC suggests that everyone between the ages of 13 and 64 should be screened for a human immunodeficiency virus. And most people who have it don't know they have it. And more, we're finding a kind of a divide between people who are technically low risk in terms of their understood risk factors who actually show up positive. And there are anti-discrimination laws now that are very good, and there is treatment that turns HIV from a death sentence into a controllable disease, a chronic disease. So that's all I have to say about that. I want to, well, actually I have one more thing to say, which is in this article, they also mention that Asian and Pacific Islanders have a high risk of having undiagnosed HIV, and this is in the heterosexual population. Not sure what that's about. It's a statistical or epidemiological factoid. Doesn't necessarily mean anything about the individual's physiology. Now, something that I read this last week is going to change the way I practice medicine. That doesn't happen too often, so I thought you'd be interested in this shift in my practice and thus in the recommendations I am going to be making. And this comes out of a story that appeared in the San Jose Mercury News about a week ago. Doctors doing too many HPV tests. And the logic here is that human papillomavirus, which is associated with cervical cancer and for which we have a vaccine, is something that is very, very widely distributed in the population. The typical natural history that has emerged now that we can test for the virus is that it occurs more frequently in unimmunized young women as they begin to be sexually active. We know that even the use of condoms doesn't really prevent its spread. And as women become infected with this, they will test positive on their pap smear if the human papillomavirus scan is done. And the logic here is that because most women will go ahead and clear the human papillomavirus on their own, and they won't have persistence of the virus, that it doesn't make a lot of sense to be screening women in the age group of under 30. Because there's a high rate of positivity, but in terms of them actually having a negative outcome from their HPV, it's very low. And meanwhile, we create a lot of worry and concern and a lot of unnecessary procedures, because when you find a positive HPV, you might go forward and do additional testing that otherwise wouldn't be done. Now, this is sort of an ostrich head in the sand approach, but on the other hand, if you actually recognize that most people are going to clear the virus and that we don't have a treatment for the virus, then why find it is actually a good question, since the only thing you do by finding it is create worry, pain, and suffering. It's unlikely that people who test positive for the virus are going to change their sexual practice, and there's no reason to change them, really. It doesn't affect the outcome of the disease, and the transmissibility is such that you're not really going to reduce the prevalence in the population. A better idea is to do pap smears every year in women under 30. And if the pap smear is abnormal, the lab should run a what's called a reflex titer or a reflex test for HPV. And there's a little box I could be checking on my forms, and I'm going to start checking that box instead of what my default has been, which is to check HPV in everybody. women over 30 should probably be screened with the HPV test, because persistence of the virus over 30 is where you start to get into issues of cervical cancer or risk for cervical cancer. There's a wonderful What About This questions, sort of the FAQ page, that is an excellent document. It's been posted in the resources at askdrdon.com. It's on our resources page, and it's a link to the CDC, who did a really beautiful job. I want to just give them a clap. A really beautiful job of public education. It's not dumbed down, and it covers the issues extremely well. The next two stories are about diabetes. Quite interesting. This is a preliminary experiment in mice, and so it may not work in humans. But the cool thing about this is that they used a vaccine which is already cleared for use in humans. So if the initial human studies work out, and it seems to be working, this is something we can safely do. It's been tested in children. It's already being used for a different purpose. And the vaccine in question is BCG, which is a vaccination of a tuberculosis-like entity that, when given to people, gives them some immunity to tuberculosis. BCG vaccination is used widely in South America. It's part of the routine vaccinations in many countries. And it can create a problem, because a person who was treated with BCG and then comes to this country, say, several years later, may test positive on a skin TB test, even though they're really reacting to, well, they're cross-reacting from the BCG. After 20 years or so, that positive TB test does go away, but the person remains to have some resistance to tuberculosis. What the researchers showed was that mice who were immunized against pancreas, so they began to develop diabetes, and their pancreas was being subject to the same sort of autoimmune onslaught that would happen in a child who's developing type 1 diabetes. Usually, as we understand this disease now, an infection sets off the immune system, and off we go with a mistaken molecular mimicry attacking the pancreas and eventually destroying it and leading to the development of diabetes. In these mice, given very low doses of BCG, it halted the immune's inappropriate attack on the pancreas, somehow turning off this runaway train. And this was fabulous. The mice began producing insulin again, and it effectively reversed the process of the development of type 1 diabetes. Now, very low doses of this vaccine used in humans with early type 1 diabetes showed transient increases in insulin production. This was announced at a meeting last Sunday at a San Diego American Diabetes Association meeting. So this is really, really cool. At Massachusetts General, they're going to be using higher doses of the vaccine in a larger number of people, see if they can prolong the response, see if, in fact, we can catch type 1 diabetes and reverse it. That would be an absolutely fabulous, fabulous outcome. In a related story, not about type 1, but about type 2 diabetes, researchers have shown, and this is Roy Taylor, head of the Magnetic Resonance Imaging Unit at Newcastle University in Britain, and his colleagues were studying diabetics. And as people became a type 2 diabetic, their MRIs of their pancreas showed the accumulation of fat. So in an experimental intervention, what they did was they took people with diabetes and they put them on a very, very, very low-calorie diet, 600 calories a day, a special protein drink, non-starchy vegetables, broccoli, asparagus, and cabbage, and lots of those. Really a crash diet. What happened was that after 1 week on the diet, these individuals had normal blood sugars. One would expect that. They weren't eating enough starch calories to have an elevated blood sugar. At the end of 8 weeks, they'd lost 33 pounds, had no signs of diabetes. Their pancreas fat levels per MRI had normalized back to the normal 6%. And 3 months afterwards, 7 of these 11 patients still were free of diabetes. They had adopted new behaviors and they weren't diabetic anymore. Now, I am pleased to see this coming out in the published literature, and I want to share with you sort of Dr. Dawn's approach to diabetes. When a patient comes to my practice with newly diagnosed diabetes type 2, I sit down with them and I ask them whether or not they want to have this disease for life or whether they want to change their behavior. And if they indicate that they're willing to do behavior change, then I give them a diet, which is not a hard diet to follow, except for the fact that you don't get to have any bread, you don't get to have any rice, you don't get to have any noodles or crackers or rice cakes. You have to give those up. And that's a huge thing for some people, and I can do that for others. For the I can do that group, I also use insulin. And the reason I use the insulin is to give their poor pancreas a break. So we put them on this diet, we give them insulin to give their pancreas a rest, and after 3 months, we withdraw the insulin, and the individual is on their own with diet only, and a few nutritionals like cinnamon and some chromium, but you know, nothing hardcore. The success rate with patient compliance is excellent. It really depends on the patient. What the doctor can do is give them good information and empower them. And I want to challenge all of the health professionals out there who listen to me to empower the patient. Give your new type 2 diabetics a glucose monitor and challenge them to check their blood sugars after they eat. When they eat on the diet, a low glycemic diet, they will have a blood sugar of 150 an hour after meal. When they have their pizza, when they have their spaghetti, when they have their whole wheat, whole grain bread, they'll have a blood sugar of 250. And you know what? They get the idea. They get the idea and they start wanting that low blood score just the same way that you want a high score on your video game and you're motivated to do something to achieve that score. Well, giving people an indicator of their progress that is immediate and in their pocket is a huge psychological boost. The next time a donut comes by, the person thinks, donut, 250. I don't think so. It makes a big difference. So let's turn around our approach to type 2 diabetes. The way I was trained in medical school, stepwise therapy is a recipe for failure. When someone comes in who is a new diabetic, you want to hit them hard, hit them fast, motivate them for change while they are still capable of getting that pancreas back. And we now have published scientific data showing that pancreatic recovery is possible in both type 1 and type 2. So let's change our approach, medicine. Let's do it. And we're talking now to Jean in Pacific Grove. Hello, Jean. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Dawn.
Thank you.
Let me see. We started a discussion 15 years ago. But we did? Yeah. Well, it was a cervical question then, and C6 and 7 or something. And you agreed that I should get a second opinion, since the first person I saw wanted to cut me right away. And I did, and physical therapy got me through it. 15 years later, it's the lumbar. I did something wrong, and I tweaked my lower back, and I had the worst 7 days of medical treatment and pain I've ever had in my life starting Memorial Day weekend. First time I went to doctors on duty, and I got something, and it was pain, and I'm not sleeping. I had 7 days of not sleeping and just having huge pain. So the first doctor I saw, she recommended, what's Dr. House on TV take all the time? Vicodin?
Vicodin.
No wonder he takes them all the time, because it didn't do anything for me. And another had a sleepless night in pain. So the next day to the ER, and saw the ER doctor, and he's said, we're going to do an MRI, and I said, I don't know how you're going to do that in my condition, so he gives me a drip. And it was a neat little drip of Dilaudid or something.
Dilaudid, yes.
Dilaudid and Toribol, a muscle relaxant, I guess. That was kind of neat. All of a sudden, I feel fine, and I go take my MRI, and he gives me, and I told him that the other medication didn't do anything for me, so he gives me something called oxycodone.
Yes.
And so I'm going, fine. What he didn't tell me, the happy juice he'd put in me to take the MRI would wear off by the time I got home. And so my pain starts again. And I take the oxycodone, and it was about as good on me as the Vicodin. Obviously, I'm not a drug addict. And more sleepless nights. So then we're through Memorial Day. I go see my doctor, and he comes up with something called lidocaine patch to put on the affected area.
Where was the affected area, by the way?
It was L2 through 5.
So on the back?
On the lower back, and it was spreading through the sciatica down the leg.
Okay.
And so also the ER doctor gave me a prescription for prednisone, naproxen.
All right.
Oh, the oxycodone.
Okay, so now we got the background here.
Right.
I'm waiting for the question.
I got through all that. Let's put it that way. And my question on this would be, nobody thought to give me a sleeping pill until I finally said, can I have a sleeping pill? Nobody thought to give me a muscle relaxant except, I guess, in that drip I had. And I didn't know to ask them. I didn't know I was spasming. Anyway, the long story short, I'm into my PT, and it's been a month. And I still have periodic pain. I'm sleeping better now, and I'm not taking any medications except Advil and no sleeping pills or anything now. Not that I'm sleeping that well. But this has been a month. Do you have an estimate of how much more PT is going to take to get this?
All right. Now,
does it take a long time for this sort of thing to...
Well, I am going to ask about the findings on the MRI. Did it show that you had ruptured a disc?
Yeah, it showed at least one, if not two, slightly bulging discs.
Slightly bulging discs?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you do not have a diagnosis, for one thing. If you only have slightly bulging discs and the level of pain that you're describing, that's not congruent. So first thing I have to say is that an acutely ruptured disc can cause severe sudden onset pain radiating down the leg. It can do all of the things that your initial presentation sounds like, or a strained ligament or a tightly spasmed piriformis muscle and maybe a half dozen other things can mimic the symptoms. And there are a few subtle tests that we do that can sometimes help us differentiate. But unfortunately, I'm going to get on the soapbox for like 10 seconds and I promise I'll jump right off. Unfortunately, the widespread availability of diagnostic imaging tests such as ultrasound for the heart and MRI for the back have led to doctors kind of forgetting their physical exam skills. Okay, I'm back off the soapbox now. Back to you, Gene. So in this case, because we don't have a diagnosis, it's very difficult to predict what your outcome is, but you've got a vector now. We have a month of symptoms, a really bad first week, but now you're on the mend. Your pain is less. It occasionally flares up. You're going to be fine. If it's ligamentous, then it's typically 2 to 3 months at a maximum. All right? And it's a gradual recovery curve. A disc is roughly the same. Essentially, what I do in my practice is if a person still has radicular pain 3 months after a disc rupture, in other words, they're still getting sciatica down the leg, at the three-month mark, I might consider sending them to a back specialist. I wait that long because 90% of the time it's gone by then. The exceptions are if I start seeing changes in motor nerves. So sensory nerves, fine. You can have the pain for a long time. If the person starts having numbness, I'm a little more worried and I watch them carefully. If they start having weakness, it's cut to the chase, go straight to the specialist. Because once you're pushing on the nerve hard enough to have weakness, then you might get permanent damage if you wait much longer. The other thing that you always want to be aware of, and this is for all back pain people out there, if you start to have problems with bladder or bowel control or you get numb in your private parts, you go to the ER. That's an emergency situation. You do not want to lose bladder function for the rest of your life. So,
okay. That I had two questions, and the second one relates to that. Because of the meds and all the pain and everything,
yes.
Well, I did have constipation for about 5 days. And
oh, yes.
I got through that, but all that time, whatever was causing this, be it the piriformis or the other, I now have a hernia. Now, can I wait to get through this back stuff and then go get the hernia checked out? And I assume they're going to have to operate on me.
Where's the hernia?
In the pelvic area.
In the pelvic. So it's going down into your testicle.
Well, no, it doesn't go that far.
Okay, so it's above?
Yeah, it's above, and it's a little bump.
A little bulge you can see. Okay. You absolutely can wait on getting the hernia repaired. Wait how long? Well, as long as you like, really. Hernias are routinely repaired in this country. That's not the case for the rest of the planet.
Oh, really?
Really. I think hernias should be repaired when they're painful and persistently painful. When the individual is at risk for incarceration, like, for example, if someone is going off to backpack through the Himalayas, or I guess you don't backpack through the Himalayas. Well, yeah, you do. Okay, yeah. So long trek through Nepal without being able to get to an emergency room within 12 hours, bad idea to do that with a hernia. The reason is an incarcerated hernia is where some of the bowel gets trapped. It's rare, but when it does occur, it can cause gangrene of the intestine. Enough said, right? You don't want to go there. So it's excruciatingly painful, and so what I tell my patients is, don't be more than 12 hours away from an emergency room, and you could live with this forever, as long as it's not hurting.
But if you went to an emergency room, what are they going to do?
They're going to take you to the operating room and decompress your bowel before it goes gangrenous.
And you're hoping there'd be somebody on duty that would be able to do that in a satisfactory and not harmful way.
It's a really basic surgery.
Yeah.
So any hospital that has an emergency room has to have a surgeon on call. It's like the law.
Yeah.
If you open up the doors as an emergency room, you have to have certain sorts of services available on the opposite end of the front door of that emergency room. You have to be able to handle an acute appendicitis. You have to be able to handle certain kinds of fractures. And if you can't handle it there, you have to be able to stabilize and evacuate.
I got you. Lifting. Is hernias, you shouldn't be lifting, I guess.
Well, yeah, basically, you shouldn't be lifting anything heavier than a toddler, and you should use proper technique, and you shouldn't use a waist belt. Those belts that people wear that you see at the warehouses and stuff, they don't prevent injuries to the back, by the way, and they do increase the risk for hernias.
Okay, well, I think that does it. Hopefully, by the end of 2 months, my back pain's gone.
There you go. All right.
Thanks, Dr. Don.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This first email is from Margaret in Santa Cruz. I'm 32 years old, and I just found out I have hypothyroidism with a TSH of 5.86. I was told by my doctor to start taking Synthroid. I had mono when I was 25, and ever since, I've never really felt the same. I'm consistently tired, low energy, sensitive to cold weather, and don't feel 100%. I also seem to catch every cold that goes around. In 2008, when I had a general blood panel, my TSH was in the normal range, 2.68. Do you think I should see an endocrinologist given my history of mono, or should I just start taking the Synthroid and see how I feel? And she wants to know about additional thyroid testing. Should I have those things? And I'll come back to that. And also alternative forms of thyroid treatment, such as iodine, thyroxine, animal hormones. All right, so here's a little primer on hypothyroidism that I hope everyone will find helpful. First of all, a person who has fatigue, low energy, sensitive to cold, and a normal TSH should have secondary functional medicine type thyroid testing, which looks at thyroid conversion. So what I typically do is I get a TSH, a total T3, and a reverse T3. And if the reverse T3, which is an inactive form of T3, is in the high end of the reference range, and the total T3, which is the active form, is in the low end of the reference range, then I know that person is misconverting their storage form, which is the T4, into an inactive form, and they should be converting it into the active form. And there are lots of people walking around doing that. Some of these individuals do respond to taking extra iodine and extra selenium, and some don't. In those that don't, who have persistent problems, one can try getting synthetic T3 in very small doses and giving that. You have to be careful because you don't want to overstimulate the heart and you don't want to cause osteoporosis. So in my practice, I monitor bone breakdown when I'm doing this. And I also am very cautious about how much T3 I might give because too much T3 is just like too much cocaine. With respect to the thyroid antibodies, I think it would be a good idea for anyone who sees a rise in their TSH, 5.86 isn't that high. That could just be from a temporary virus infection, or it could be real. And if it is real, you'll probably find thyroid autoantibodies. Now, there's a lovely, mysterious story about this, because it turns out that on the thyroid, there's an antigen that closely resembles gliadin, which is the antigen in gluten that everyone is so worried about, or that's kind of become a fashionable diagnosis. And just by the way, just because something is fashionable doesn't mean it's not true. In this case, gluten sensitivity is currently fashionable, but there are a lot of people out there who are genuinely sensitive, and that's just the way it is. Sorry, guys, there's plenty of evidence, and it's true, but who and how much and what do we do about it is still up for grabs. I'll grant you that. Let's go to another email, this one from Christiane in Santa Barbara. Christiane writes, I was diagnosed in 2009 with breast cancer, invasive, well-differentiated ductal adenocarcinoma with small component of low-grade ductal carcinoma in situ, nothing in the lymph glands. She has estrogen receptors and progesterone receptors, and she was 62 at the time, taking bioidentical hormone replacement. She went on and had a double mastectomy and reconstruction, and before that surgery, her blood levels were all normal. But after that surgery, her platelets became low as well as her white blood cells, and this is without having begun any chemotherapy. Before my surgery, platelets were 159 and white cells were 4.3. After the surgery in January 2010, my platelets were 134 and my white blood cells were 2.9, again, without having done chemo. Today, I constantly test low, but higher than the first low numbers. Platelets continue to be down. I've started taking selenium and eating Brazil nuts. These have been shown to help with raising white blood cell levels. She has an oncologist who was worried that she might have an autoimmune problem, so she had an ANA test done, and that was positive. She has just a positive ANA. She doesn't have DNA antibody, and so she's testing positive for one autoimmune marker, but she doesn't have a nameable autoimmune disease. She is African American, and she wants to know what suggestions I have. So, Christiane, first of all, anyone who shows up with low white blood cells after surgery, it's probably related to something that was done around that time of that surgery. Could have been antibiotics, could have been anesthesia toxicity, could have been something. And I don't have, I'm not blaming the anesthesia because I think there was already a problem waiting to happen and the anesthesia just kicked it off. Just the stress of the surgery could be the proximate cause. Now, autoimmune diseases are tricky. In their early stages, they are hard to identify. The first thing I would recommend is a vitamin D level. Extremely important, particularly in African Americans, to get a vitamin D level annually. African Americans have low vitamin D levels, and they also have higher rates of autoimmune disease, particularly in women. So it's extremely important to check this out. The other thing that would have happened when you stopped your, when you had your surgery is you would have stopped your hormones. And your bioidentical hormone replacement therapy was providing you possibly with some hormones that were actually having an effect on your bone marrow. So that's a third variable that you haven't considered as possibly having causation. But multiple things happened when you had your surgery, and one of them was that you stopped your hormones. You want to continue to be very careful. Supplement vitamin D if you're not at least 45. Get your blood levels up to that. I think that's enough for restricting autoimmune disease. In the early autoimmune kind of smoldering situations like this, I think it's extremely important to also support the bowel flora. All of these things are just empiric, won't hurt, might help kind of measures. And I won't claim any great double-blind placebo-controlled study that supports the advice I'm giving, but there are small studies and there are plausible mechanisms to make this sensible, practical advice. And it doesn't involve pharmaceuticals. It is important to continue to work with your oncologist. Don't abandon conventional medicine when you have a disease like this. I love blended medicine, but I would definitely want to have an oncologist on my team if I was fighting breast cancer. Let's go to Maria in Santa Cruz. Hello, Maria. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. I know you're not an oncologist, but I really trust your knowledge, and I just have some questions regarding my mother.
Go ahead.
At about 79, she got her first breast cancer, and she had a lumpectomy, chemotherapy, and radiation. And then she went on tamoxifen for many years, and then they switched it to aromacin. She's the type of woman that hates meds, and she decided she'd go off the aromacin eventually after, you know, God, basically she was, you know, considered a cancer survivor. 7 years had gone on, and nothing had come up. Well, then about 9 years later, after that first initial thing, she'd been off the aromacin about a year and a half.
Uh-huh.
She developed her first bone met in the femur area. And I won't go on and on. They basically did a little bit of surgery in there, like almost like a hip replacement operation where they put in titanium. Mm-hmm. And then she received radiation. She's very anti-chemo and does not want any. And then about 2 years after that, she developed another bone met. She never went on. She never went back on Aromacin.
Okay.
So now this was, just this spring. And here now they just found another one. So she had received radiation for that second bone met and had been going on high doses of supplements, things like green tea and mushrooms and whatnot.
And so now we are, if I've counted correctly, we're 12 years out from her initial diagnosis?
Yeah, I guess so. She's 86.
Okay. So what is your question?
My question is about medications for her. She did finally just go back on the Aromacin, and we're looking at the Zometa, the bisphosphonate.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a deep fear about that, about the osteonecrosis possibility of the jaw.
Well, how are her teeth?
Well, she has had, the receding gum thing in the past. So she would definitely need some kind of dental exam prior to going on this.
Right.
And she has good kidney function.
Well, I tend to be a little bit of a alarm. I don't want to say I'm an alarmist. That's the wrong word. I find osteonecrosis of the jaw very spooky because we don't have a good diagnostic study.
Mm.
We have some alternative type things. We have a CT of the jaw study that some of the biological dentists use. We have another sort of ultrasound kind of thing that is promoted. I forget the name of it, but it's a proprietary technology. And of course, they say that it works great, but you won't find any studies in the literature that really back it up.
Mm-hmm.
And the concept of being able to look deep at the root of the teeth and figure out if someone actually has an infection is very, very new. We're just now getting acknowledgement and some traction in medical circles about the concept.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very worrisome to think that we could change the structure of bone into something that would make it impossible for the immune system to fight off infection.
Wow. Well said.
That's like, oh, I really don't want to do that to people and then find out 5 or 10 years later, because what are we going to do, remove large sections of the jaw? That would be a horrible mistake to make.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in your mother's circumstance,
mm-hmm.
I'm really glad she went back on her estrogen blocker. Essentially, Aromacin is a reductase, it's an alpha reductase inhibitor, which means it prevents estrogen from being made by any body tissue.
Mm-hmm.
And estrogen is food for breast cancers.
Yes.
And all of these bone mets happened at the time of her initial cancer. Okay? They went out there, they spread through the body, and they sat there.
Okay.
And they sat there in dormancy.
Oh.
And probably they may not have had the final mutation.
Mm-hmm.
And the final mutation is the one that lets you start building blood vessels. So the way it goes is like this. Cancer cells fall off of the cancer and they get into the bloodstream. And that happens early, unfortunately. There are blood tests now available in Europe, and I think one company in Florida is importing them. I'm not sure how good they are, but what they purport to do is measure actual cancer cells in the bloodstream. And that's absolutely doable. Quest Diagnostics is doing it right now for colon cancer. But their test, I'm not sure how accurate it is, but they're advertising the heck out of it. The point is that, yes, we can do this. We can find cancer cells. We can find cells that have a mutation that's sort of a marker for cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do that on breast cancer, what we find out is that there's a lot of breast cancer cells floating around the bloodstream. Most of those will die. Most of those will never take root.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do manage to get out of the bloodstream and get into a tissue, say bone, they can't go anywhere because they don't have the ability to get enough fuel. They're sitting there on the fringe eating table scraps and barely surviving, and they don't have enough food to grow and start multiplying and doubling and then doubling again and so on. And that's how you get something you can actually see on a bone scan. So something happens after 5 years, after 10 years, these cells develop the ability to grow new blood vessels.
Mm-hmm.
Once they can grow new blood vessels, then they're true new cancers, and they start growing. So the cells that break off don't have the new blood vessel growing capability. If they did, they would have gone on long ago. But we keep them suppressed, essentially, with the Aromacin.
I see.
And so that's why it's used. It's used because we know that there's probably some cells out there, or often there are, Mm-hmm. And if we use this long term in those women who have those cells out there, we keep them from waking up and growing big enough to be trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, by stopping it, she really did allow them to take root and grow.
Mm-hmm.
So
I see.
She's a grown woman. She made a decision.
Yeah.
It turns out that was the wrong decision.
Mm-hmm.
How many times have you made a decision and, you know, gone 5 years later, wished you'd made a different one?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is called being alive.
It is.
So that being said, I'm glad she's back on the Aromasin. And I'm ambivalent about Zomita. What Zomita does is it makes bone hard to break down. So it makes it hard for the cancer cells to replace it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the idea, is that you harden the bone effectively, and then the cancers can't grow as big in the bone. Mm-hmm. And that does work. But if somebody had bad teeth,
this is a real concern.
I would be so worried that I'd be creating another problem.
Okay.
That I'd really look carefully at what the studies show about benefit in her situation. And maybe, you know, your choices are stay on the Aromasin and wait for another bone met to show up and sort of come break through the Aromasin.
And then just
And then radiation. At that point say, okay, irradiate it, and maybe we'll do Zomita, or maybe we won't. In the meanwhile, and this is a radical approach, and I'm not I'm not advocating for it, I'm really pointing it out.
Yeah.
She could have all her teeth removed and get dentures. And then she doesn't have to worry about, it's radical, but then she doesn't have to worry about osteonecrosis.
Well, that's a good point, though.
And 50 years ago, people didn't have teeth by the time they were in their 80s.
Yeah.
You know, everybody had dentures. And yeah, your teeth sat in a glass by the side of your bed. But in some ways, you know, when I'm seeing the kinds of problems that people with bad teeth in old age go, the old, you know, dental remove bad teeth thing isn't such a bad idea.
That's interesting.
And if you don't have the $50,000 it takes for restoration work.
Mm-hmm.
So something to think about.
Okay, one other question quick in that regard.
Sure.
Is the one thing that concerns me about her with these bone mets is the hypercalcemia that occasionally comes up. And from what I read on the internet, that's why these days, that's what they told me on the internet, that people are surviving these breast to bone mets a lot better since they have bisphosphonates, because that eliminates basically people dying from hypercalcemia. What do you think about that?
Well, it's true that hypercalcemia is a very dangerous problem, because it can stop your heart.
Yeah.
And that's about as dangerous as it gets.
Mm-hmm.
I'm feeling like I want to know where on the internet you're hearing this and whether or not the forum is sponsored by the bisphosphonate people.
Well, that's a good question.
Because
I'll check that out.
You know, there's a certain self-interest there that might be operating in terms of such strong advocacy. I haven't ever had a patient die of hypercalcemia from breast cancer. You know, I don't know what the frequency of that is.
Mm-hmm. I've just seen her when she's under the influence of it, of the hypercalcemia, and besides the really bad constipation she gets, just the mental instability, it's really hard to deal with.
Okay, well, in that circumstance, maybe the Zomita is worth doing, but I, you know, you're really taking a risk if she's got bad teeth.
No, I'm listening to everything you're saying. Okay.
All right.
Okay, and last thing, if you know, are there any new drugs that, I mean, I guess they would be more specifically targeted to breast cancer cells in the bone?
Yes, always.
Yes, always.
Yes,
okay.
There are always new drugs, and the problem is toxicity. Those drugs are being tested, and the trick is you have to find something that works better than what we've got and isn't highly toxic, and that takes years. And so in terms of where things are in the pipeline, the best place to get that information is to go to the NIH website. Their cancer website is fantastic.
Good, I'll
and
do that.
And it does provide not only, you can search by the type of cancer and by the severity, and then they'll tell you about what clinical studies are doing what drugs. You live near two tertiary medical centers, it may be possible to get in a clinical trial.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Bye.
We had an off-air question about folds in earlobes and heart disease. This is something that crops up every now and then, and I was actually taught in medical school that it is a marker for heart disease. But when you go out and look at a couple of large epidemiologic proactive studies that were done, I think in the 90s, they failed to find a durable correlation. So at this point, we seem to have better markers for heart disease than earlobe creases. And I don't think that it provides much added value. That being said, one comment that was made by a neonatologist is that it could be that because the earlobe and the heart valves develop at about the same time, that there is a correlation that that crease might indicate that there was an injury to the fetus just at that critical moment when the heart valves are developing. So it's an interesting comment. I will have to look and see if there's any epidemiological data on that correlation with not heart disease like coronary artery disease, which is what I was taught, but valvular heart disease. Let's go to Sarah in Live Oak. Hello, Sarah, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don. I talked with you 2 weeks ago about my nephew's cancer, a lump near his stomach and esophagus, and I just learned that it's stage 4.
Of what kind of cancer?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's a mass.
Yes, I understand. If they're calling it stage 4 cancer, then that probably means that that lump by his esophagus came from somewhere else. So it, by definition, that is a metastasis, a distant metastasis, which is automatically making you stage 4. And then the question is, what cell type is it? In some cancers, and I saw a patient the other day, briefly I'll just tell you this story, she fell down and she bled in the middle of her liver, which was very odd. You don't normally bruise the inside of your liver when you fall down a short flight of stairs. Turned out that what happened was that she had a cancer in the middle of her liver that no one suspected, and that's what bled. And because of her having the bleeding, we looked and found the cancer, and it was a metastasis. And we've never found the primary. We've looked everywhere in her body for that primary cancer, and it has not been located. So she's been treated, of course, with chemotherapy and the appropriate agents, but still, sometimes you don't find where the cancer started.
Mm-hmm.
That may be the situation with your nephew, or it may be that he has a tumor in his bladder or his colon or his testicle or something like that. How old is he?
40.
40, okay. He's old for testicular cancer. In any event, if they're calling it stage 4, then it's probably coming from a distance. And so if you can't find the primary, you just go by the cell type and treat using the agents that would normally be used for cancers of that cell type.
Mm-hmm.
So is it a squamous cell? Is it a glandular derivative, et cetera, et cetera? And they have all kinds of special staining that helps them narrow it down, even mm-hmm. when the cells have lost a lot of their markers.
Okay, well, that's new information for me. I just, my initial question, the reason I called is thinking if it's stage 4, that's in stages, I thought, which is why would you want to put yourself through the miserable life of chemotherapy? If you're going to die anyway.
You'd do it to die later. And that's always the question when you're doing chemotherapy. What I always ask, and I recommend this for everyone, if you don't know this about your cancer therapy, figure it out. Is there a possibility of a cure? Is this chemotherapy curative? In which case, if there's a chance for a cure, you maybe want to put yourself through a lot of misery for that chance for a cure. That's an individual decision. I'm going to leave it to the individual.
Uh-huh.
Is it palliative? And palliative means you're doing it just to live a little bit longer or maybe to treat a symptom. We were talking earlier to a woman whose mother has a cancer in the bone, which hurts. And so we do palliative radiation. We try to stop that cancer from growing by blasting it with radiation so that she doesn't have the pain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so intention is really key when you ask the question about risk-benefit. And you don't know enough to even frame the question for your...
No, I just know the cancer doctor said 1 in 4 chance of survival with this kind of cancer.
Okay, we need to be really clear on, is that 5-year survival? Is that disease-free survival? Because those would be very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
So once you know what type of cancer it is, then you can start asking those questions.
Yeah, or just try to stop worrying so much and let them handle it.
Well, where is your nephew?
Way up in Olympia.
Olympia, Washington.
Yeah.
Is he with or without health insurance?
No health insurance.
No health insurance.
We're, you know, 3 months worth through his construction job, but that's ending soon.
Okay. Yeah. So we have a 40-year-old with stage 4 cancer, probably not a high-income individual.
No.
So he'll qualify for whatever the state of Washington has as Medicaid. Medicaid will cover, at least if I can extrapolate from my California experience, Medicaid will cover chemotherapy, it will cover appropriate cancer workup, and once he's qualified for it, he'll get that. My concern in his case is if he has too much money, there may be a delay before he actually qualifies for the medical care. And that would be bad under any circumstances. But will it make a difference if he already has stage 4 cancer? I couldn't say without knowing more details that may not even be known at this point.
Yeah.
I wish we had national health care. I wish everybody had health care. I think we need a mandate. I'm glad the mandate got upheld in court recently, because 40-year-old men, 35-year-old men in denial, I'm strong, I'm healthy, I don't need insurance. These are exactly the people that need a mandate. Okay, no, you don't get to make that decision, because you can get cancer at 40. And if you don't have health insurance, you know, first of all, it's all of our tax dollars at work. And secondly, by the time you actually get to a doctor and start getting appropriate care, your care is going to be more expensive because it wasn't caught early.
Mm-hmm.
So what part of throw good money after bad does our current patchwork system with, you know, individual choice? You don't choose to get sick. You don't choose not to get sick. Mm-hmm. This is not up for choice. It's your social responsibility to have health insurance. It's society's responsibility to provide health insurance or ensure the provision of health insurance, however the society decides to do this. I hear stories about this all the time. It just drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'll step off the soapbox.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Well,
thank you.
I'm sorry for your situation. I'm sorry for you and your nephew.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We had so many really good emails this week, and I'm not going to get through all of them, but I'm going to try a couple. This one from Patrick in Pacific Grove. I'm a mid-50s male taking finasteride. That's Proscar for benign prostatic hypertrophy. And I was experiencing the need for frequent urination. Seems to have helped, but does finasteride affect libido? And the answer to that is, yeah, it definitely does. In some people, reduce libido and reduce erections. Technically, what finasteride does is it inhibits the conversion of testosterone to dihydrotestosterone, and dihydrotestosterone is the one that is a growth hormone for the prostate and for the hair follicle, which is why finasteride is also used at a lower dose for male pattern baldness. But I want to raise the issue, Patrick, that maybe you have an enlarged prostate because you have low testosterone levels and you have andropause, and that means as you get into your 40s and 50s, your testosterone levels drop. And that's actually associated statistically with lower libido and with larger prostates, ironically, which is kind of a problem because if you give testosterone to someone with a large prostate, it may get larger. So the combination of finasteride with testosterone might be a reasonable plan if you can get your doctor to consider it. And good luck to you. We got one last caller, and we're going to go to Judy in SoCal. Hello, Judy, and welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, and I was doubly inspired, I always am, by something you said earlier. My osteoporosis is apparently advanced enough. I'm 65. I've broken 3 major bones in my 50s. I have been prescribed Forteo, having had Fosamax for 15 years. Stopped that about 5 years ago. I just need your opinion of Forteo. It feels very unknown to me.
Well, I have limited experience with Forteo because it's an injectable and it's expensive, and you usually have to be seeing a specialist before
right.
it gets prescribed.
Right.
But I've read about it, and I understand the mechanism of action, and I actually think it's a really... It's a really good drug. At least my current opinion is that this is a good one.
Excellent.
It is cumbersome to have to inject yourself. And if you get too much calcium going in, you can end up with hypocalcemia, and you can also end up with calcification of other tissues.
Right.
And we don't know what's up with that. Probably individual variations in response. That's usually what's going on, and we don't know what DNA patterns to test for. But in your circumstance, your risk-benefit equation is you got some serious risk, lady, and you've got big potential for benefit.
Right.
So your very apparent risk as far as I'm concerned, outweighs the unknown risk of using this agent.
Okay, that makes me feel better. I've got Crohn's disease also, and don't know whether that created malabsorption. You know, I've had that since I was 18.
Yes, of course it did. It created malabsorption. It was your intestines been damaged since you were 18, so you've had problems absorbing calcium all these years.
Yep.
You probably also had a lot of steroids, too, because when you were 18...
I actually avoided them.
Oh, you did? Really? Yeah. Even rectal steroids?
Excuse me?
Even the rectal steroid enemas?
Yep.
Oh, I'm impressed because that's unusual.
Yes. No, I am fanatical about certain foods will set it off and I don't eat them, and high fats. And then I do get a great relief from Acicol.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
And Acicol is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory
that's
put in the rectum. The only problem I have with Acicol is that it does increase gut permeability. But then, of course, so does Crohn's disease.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm already there.
Exactly.
So, yeah, and I actually take it in pill form, 8 to 12 pills a day.
Just be careful with your Forteo to follow the package instructions and make sure that you get blood levels for calcium done periodically.
That was my other question. Therefore, there is a way, and under what periodic...
I don't know. I would, first of all, just go online and pull down the package insert and read it from cover to cover with a medical dictionary under your left hand.
Yeah, got it.
All right.
Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Don.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We're going to try to get one quick question in. Linda in Santa Cruz, we only have just a couple minutes, but I thought I'd take you and try to answer your question.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'll outline. My mother's 83. She keeps on having really an outbreak of hives all over her body. I think it's kind of an inflammatory condition. She's very healthy, Tai Chi, swimming, runs my sister's office, a very determined, optimistic, and fat English woman.
And you're going to tell me she's not on any pharmaceuticals, right, at the time that she develops her hives?
Not at all. She's been hypothyroid, refuses statins. You know, she's on red yeast rice. Her liver values look pretty good.
She's on statins, by the way. Red yeast rice.
I know.
Okay. So just so you know. But let me make sure I know your question. Go ahead and ask the question.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, should I just give her a Depomedrol dose kit? Or she's 83. That seems kind of extreme for me, but she has this periodically and she's miserable with it.
No.
Goes to a homeopathist, acupuncture, etc.
No, you shouldn't. And the reason I say no to Depomedrol is that in placebo studies, it doesn't work. Okay, how about that? If you actually do placebo, Depomedrol and prednisone don't work for hives.
Okay, very good.
Okay, so what does work? First of all, a combination of H2 blockers, H1 and H2 blockers. So you're talking Benadryl and Tagamet or some combination of the above. And you can use children's doses on the Benadryl, so it isn't usually too sedating even for an
Right, even during the day, use a half dose or something like that.
Yeah, 12.5, the children's dose. Is 12.5. So a children's dose and, an over-the-counter dose or even double the over-the-counter dose of the cimetidine block the H2 and the H1 receptors. That reduces the hives quite a bit. You got to look at ingestion. What was she eating when she started having this? She triggered it somehow. It was something that she put in her mouth. Could have been pollen, could have been food, could have been a drug, could have been an herb tea. And whatever was new around the time it started needs to get gone.
We keep on trying to investigate this, because
If you're getting periodic outbreaks spaced at least a month apart, you're getting periodic re-exposures. So eventually you may find it. Good luck. If you want to call.
Thank you so much. That was tremendously helpful.
Bye-bye.
Enjoy your weekend. Bye-bye.
This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.